All right, and we should be live here. Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Adam Taggart, CEO of Wealthion, welcoming you back for another interview here with my great friend, Stephanie Pomboy. Stephanie, how are you doing? And thanks so much for joining us.
I'm doing great. Thank you. It's always so much fun to be with you. And I guess fun might not be the word after people hear the doom and gloom, but
we'll see. We'll just try to give an unvarnished view of where things are headed. And I know you just came back from a conference, Stephanie. So thank you for making the time to talk with the Wealthion folks. But I'm also guessing you've got some good insights from that. Real quick, folks, as we start here, Stephanie joins me once a month. And we, the intent here is to have a nice conversation with Stephanie about her macro outlook, but then leave some time to get some live Q&A from the audience. Stephanie is my first and best guinea pig here who's been willing to do this. Again, we'll have a nice conversation, and then I promise I'll get to the live chat and we'll take as many questions as we can get to in the remaining time here. And if you're watching this on replay, thanks so much for joining us. Folks in the live chat, do us a favor, just say hi, tell us where you're watching from. And when we get to the Q&A part, I'll let you know, and that's when you can ask your questions there. All right, but folks don't want to hear me talk, Stephanie. They want to hear you talk, so I'm going to bring you back in here. I'm going to try to just play around with some of the bells and whistles in this new software here.
Can you make my face about half a size smaller than it is right now?
No, not at all. You look great. Can you see this?
Oh, there we go.
Can you see this chart of world GDP?
I do.
All right. So I'm just putting this up here to set the table for you, Stephanie. But economic growth around the world is slowing, right? We had a ton of stimulus pumped into the system around the world. It gave us a bit of a sugar rush from the second half of 2020 through 2021. 2022 was the start of the hangover. And of course, the big question right now is, are we going to be able to engineer a soft landing to all of this, or are we going to go into a recession? And if so, how bad of one? So I think that's sort of the table that's set here. And I know you got a lot of thoughts about this, so why don't I let you just sort of start running?
I do. Well, thanks again, Adam, for having me. For your familiar with me, my general approach to the markets is to identify what outcome is priced into the markets and try to, using my analysis of the economy, discern areas where that expectation might run afoul. And so right now we have a very firm consensus that we're heading into a recession. And so you have a lot of people out there saying, well, if that's a consensus, therefore, we won't have a recession, it'll be a soft landing, and that's the contrarian bet. My view is that the contrarian bet is that this recession is going to be as bad, if not worse, than the 2008 financial crisis. And I'll go into the reasons why. But the consensus, while they are forecasting a recession this year, expects the barest of recessions. They expect a short and shallow two-quarter affair that almost barely meets the technical definition of, two back-to-back quarters of negative growth. So yes, the consensus is forecasting a recession, but they see it being a mild affair. And I think that based on what the Fed's done so far, it will be anything but. Going back to that Fed tightening, I would encourage people to think about the Fed rate hikes that we've seen so far, not as a tightening cycle, but as an interest rate shock. What they've done in terms of the speed and magnitude of rate hikes is utterly unprecedented. I know people draw parallels to Volcker, and obviously the nominal level of interest rates was substantially higher then. But the rate of change that he undertook was nothing compared to what we've seen today. And importantly, or rather crucially, debt back then was nothing. I mean, today we are toting enormous amounts of debt, not just in the government sector, but in the consumer and more importantly on the corporate side. So the vulnerability to these higher interest rates is much higher today than it was in Paul Volcker's time. And I think one of the reasons why there's so much complacency about this soft, you know, short and shallow recession is that so far the impact of the Fed's rate hikes has been relatively mild. I mean, for sure, we've seen an enormous decline in housing activity. But other than that, it's hard to see where we've had any dramatic impact on the economy. And you certainly haven't seen much of a dramatic impact on the financial markets. We had, you know, a stock market correction last year, and we've since recovered our footing a little bit. And it just, it hasn't been a panic or a crisis or anything that got out of control. And so I think that's imbued complacency about, you know, what impact this full tightening will really have. And again, you know, that's why I go back to the idea that it's an interest rate shock, and that so far we really haven't seen the impact. And when we do, that impact is going to be really profound and no one's prepared for it. I can see you're like the cat that swallowed the canary over there, Adam.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to ask a clarifying question because this is such an important point, I think, which is you know, we saw it hit the housing market first because that's one of the most interest rate sensitive parts of the economy, right? And it, you know, there was a bit of a delay in hitting the housing market because people get approved for mortgages, and I think they have something like 3 months or so to use that approved rate that they were granted, right? But we're long past the people right. that still had 3% mortgages now, and so clearly the housing market is now fully in rollover at this point in time. Mm-hmm. As you and I have talked about in the past, in terms of the general economy, there's a much longer lag when you know, the Fed pulls a lever and the results of that manifest in the true economy. And I know people put a range on that, but the midpoint I've sort of seen is around 9 months or so. And assuming it is 9 months, you know, then we're only really just now beginning mm-hmm. to see, you know, the full impact of the very initial rate hikes the Fed made starting back in March of last year, right?
Absolutely. And the fact is, you're already seeing it reflected in a deteriorating credit quality. We've seen an uptick in credit card delinquencies, and obviously auto loans have really suffered. But on the corporate side, which is my primary focus, because after the housing bubble bust, consumers were pretty reticent to borrow aggressively. And while they have run up credit card balances dramatically in the last 12 months, they've done so really just to keep up with the rising cost of everything they can't live without. Right. And now, you know, in the recent data, they've actually been trying to rebuild their savings a little bit. So I don't think the excesses on the credit side are really on the consumer balance sheet so much as they are on the corporate side, which was the primary credit taker during this free money bonanza. And Bloomberg just reported that in January, large corporate bankruptcy filings were the largest since 2010. So you're already starting to see things turn. And as I suggested with this idea that it was an interest rate shock, that hit when it happens, and like you said, it's just starting to come through now, is going to be much more profound than the markets presently expect. You know, they're looking for sort of a gradual and modest deterioration in credit conditions. And I think we'll see something far more severe, and that it will play out much more rapidly. You know, as you acutely point out, the interest rate hit doesn't happen until you have to pay higher interest rates, obviously. So, you know, if you have an adjustable rate mortgage, and they take mortgage rates to, you know, 7% at the peak, that didn't affect you at all if you didn't have a reset. It only affects you when the time comes to reset. And the same is true, obviously, on the corporate side. And on that score, you know, there are several myths around the strength of corporate balance sheets, but an important one is that companies shrewdly took the opportunity to lock in the incredibly low borrowing costs that we saw during the pandemic stimulus bonanza for as long as they possibly could. You know, they borrowed long, long, long. And the fact is that they may have borrowed long, but they borrowed a ton short. And we know that because there's $1 trillion in corporate debt here in the US that has to roll this year. And then there's another trillion that has to roll next year. And there's another trillion in 2025. So there's gonna be no relief from this impact of higher interest rates in the foreseeable horizon. And the only thing I guess that could stave off a significant wave of corporate delinquencies would be for the Fed to swiftly pivot and cut rates back down to where they started from.
Yeah. So, all right. So what's interesting, and that was a really interesting set about the large corporate bankruptcies being so high now. You know, we've seen the, in some ways, some of the stronger companies have been the first to really like lay off substantial amount of workers, which is interesting, right? You know, it's the Googles, it's the Amazons, the Apples, even companies with, you know, some of the strongest balance sheets out there, Microsoft, right? We have this theoretical kind of 20% of the corporate fleet that's supposed to be a zombie company, right?
Right.
and I wonder what's going to happen here. It's so interesting to me. I would have thought that you would have seen the smaller guys, those overextended zombies, die off first, and then it would work its way up the quality chain. And I'm sure that's probably the way it'll play out in the long run.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that the layoff wave seems to be starting at these higher companies. But I assume as you project forward here, given both the higher cost of capital, which you just talked about, but also if demand keeps getting, you know, lowered because of these higher interest rates and the slowing economy, that, you know, I imagine you're going to see profit margins get squeezed to the point where we're really going to start, the layoff dam will burst, right? Companies do everything they can to avoid laying people off, and then they finally got to make it happen. So are you, you know, sort of projecting when you say this recession is going to be, you know, on par with what we saw in 08, are you expecting sort of similar scale layoffs like we saw back then?
I do. I think it's not surprising that they're happening with such a lag because it was so hard to get workers. And I think your point about how the largest, healthiest companies are the ones laying off first maybe underscores the dynamic we saw in that they had the easiest time hiring and retaining workers because they have the ability to provide so many benefits and, you know, 401k matching or whatever it is and fancy cafeterias. And so the Googles and the Amazons, et cetera, maybe didn't have as hard a time hiring workers and retaining them as your mom and pop shop or the local restaurant down the street. And so if you had a hard time finding someone and you just got them a couple of months ago, your a desire to let them go the second sales turn down is pretty limited. You want to wait and see, is this a prolonged downturn or is this just a blip that we're going to sustain? Because we don't want to have to go back and try to search again to hire, you know, workers who are hard to find. So
that's a good point. And sorry to interject real quick, yeah. But I'm going to answer my own question here, which is I do know one reason why a lot of these big Silicon Valley companies are the first to lay off is because they were in a war for talent where they were hiring people who they didn't have an immediate use for. They just didn't want them going to a competitor. Uh-huh. So they had a chunk of their workforce. I mean, obviously they also had a lot of, you know, forgive my French, but the bullshit jobs, right? You know, the head of fun, you know, the chief diversity right. officer, that type of stuff. But they also had a bunch of people, you know, I would say a material percentage of their you know, maybe even a double digit percentage of their workforce that was there just kind of in the bullpen. Like, you know, we'll hopefully find a use for them at some point in time, but we're starving our competitors of this talent, right? And when you realize that you got to start tightening your belt, well, those are the easiest folks to get rid of because you weren't using them anyways.
Right, right. No, that's a great point. So I guess the upshot is that we all know the labor dynamics in this cycle are really unique following the pandemic experience. So it's not surprising that it's going to take a little longer for that shoe to drop, but I am confident, as you suggested, that the shoe is going to drop and we will see, you know, a significant decline in employment growth. You know, the number one input, obviously, into hiring is profit growth. And I've been forecasting a profits recession for more than a year now based on the margin squeeze that we've been seeing in terms of, you know, relentlessly high energy and other commodity prices at a time when the ability to pass those on to consumers who are increasingly spent up and lent right. up is really diminishing. And, you know, like I said earlier, they had been running up their credit cards to try to keep up with it. And now their appetite to do that seems to have hit the wall. So this is a real problem going forward for corporate profits. And I just checked before we jumped on here as to what the estimate was for 2023 S&P earnings growth, and they're down to basically zero growth. They're still not forecasting a recession, but we've come down from, you know, 10% plus earnings growth in 2023 to zero on its way to minus 20 would be my expectation. And that sounds like a ridiculous number, but one of the tightest fits other than the profit margin proxy that I look at that tracks, you know, input costs versus the ability to pass them on, is CEO confidence. The Conference Board comes out with a quarterly survey of CEO confidence. And if you go back to the beginning of the survey and chart it versus growth and profits, whenever it's this low as it is right now, you've seen a 20%+ decline in earnings growth. So it's not out of the realm of possibility, but you know, it would just have to start moving in that direction before the stock market realizes, okay, we've been a little bit too complacent about the outlook here.
All right. And I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the Fed. So in a perfect world, Stephanie, you and I would be having this conversation tomorrow, and we would know right. what Powell had just said.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to intuit. But the Fed is his. So I had an interview with recorded an interview with Jim Rickards, who you recorded an interview with on this channel.
Love Jim.
And Jim talked about how there's kind of this war of narratives going on right now, and it's a real, you know, the investor has to decide which story are they going to believe. Right. And the market is basically pricing in this sort of like, you know, perfect butterfly soft landing. Nice. Right. And the data is telling a totally different story. The reality on the ground seems to be telling a totally different story. And there's the Fed's story as well. Right. And the Fed is, you know, the way that Jim sort of talks about it is that the Fed is saying, look, we got this, but there's going to be some pain involved. Mm-hmm. And the market is saying, I don't believe you. You know, right. you're going to pivot way too soon, way sooner than you think, and this is going to be a nothing burger. And then reality is saying, I think what you're saying, Stephanie, which is like, hey, you know, this is not going to be good, folks. Time to assume the crash position, more or less. And if I can, I just want to dial through some stats before we dive into that part of the conversation, great, real quick. Yeah. So I put up the you know, just big picture world real GDP is on the decline here, right? But if you look at the, you know, the US stats, right, we see inflation coming down, mm-hmm, right? It's still higher than folks want, right? I mean, the latest number we have is what, 6.7. We're going to find out soon enough what the January numbers were. But it's definitely coming down, like the Fed's tractor beam is working, right? Mm-hmm. If we look at like the ISM stats for both manufacturing and services, we're in contraction. Mm-hmm. Right. So those stats are saying, okay, you know, the economy is not growing anymore. Real wages, they have been negative for the past 21 months straight. Mm-hmm. Right. The savings rate is down at abysmal lows. Consumer savings rate, as you mentioned earlier, credit card debt is back up at record highs. Mm-hmm. We're seeing delinquencies really start to spike now. So all of those things are saying, hey, look, you know, things are looking kind of grim, right? Economy is really slowing, consumers getting into trouble. I just want to mention two more indicators. One is the inverted yield curves, right? Mm-hmm. Those are one of our best predictors of recession coming ahead. I don't know if absolutely every curve is inverted at this point in time, but certainly feels like almost all of them are. Mm-hmm. And then there's this one. There's the leading economic indicators. Here's the Conference Board top 10 leading economic mm-hmm. indicator index. And this has a 100% hit rate on anticipating recessions when it goes negative. And as you can see here, right on the right side of the chart, circled in red, you know, we're down at levels that so far in this data series, which goes back to the at least the early 70s, not the 60s, is coincident with recessions. So, you know, it's kind of like, who are we going to believe? The meteorologist right. on TV who's telling us it's going to be a sunny day, or our eyes looking out the window and seeing the thunder, lightning, and rain? right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was reminiscent to me of the mostly peaceful protest with the reporter with the building on flames behind him. You know?
or Baghdad Bob saying, we have repulsed the Americans from Iraq and like the tanks are rolling in behind him.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I would add to your list of weak economic data or recession signals, two things that have been signaling recession for a very long time, and that is the consumer plans to buy a home or an automobile, which is in that University of Michigan survey. They went through recession levels many, many months ago. So the consumer's been telling us for quite a while that a recession was coming. The interesting thing, as you talk about this battle to win hearts and minds between the Fed and Wall Street, that really is the whole story, because the more Wall Street denies this data and insists the Fed's going to pivot in time to engineer this perfect Goldilocks landing, the harder the Fed has to work to get that tightening of financial conditions that is the mechanism through which the economy will slow and inflation will cool. So it really is a cat and mouse game between the Fed and the markets right now. And basically, since the Fed started tightening in March last year, and they insisted, you know, we're going to be aggressive, we're going to take rates higher, and we're going to hold them there longer than the markets expect, the markets continue to just go, blah, 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 blah. You know, they just don't want to hear it.
They don't. And I'm going to put up a chart as you're saying, you're saying that, which I think, you know, shows exactly what you're saying, which is, this is Bloomberg's Financial Conditions Index, and it is looser today, substantially so, than when the Fed started its hiking campaign back in March.
This is the real problem for the Fed. And the question is, how aggressive are they willing to be? My brain is moving faster than my tongue today.
Oh, no worries. And I'm surprising you with my you know, stunning ability to bring up charts as we talk.
No, I'm very impressed. I'm glad you're doing this, because I definitely couldn't. this is the problem for the Fed, is how tough are they willing to beat it into Wall Street's head that they are going to be more aggressive. And the more Wall Street ignores them, the higher they're going to push rates and the longer they're going to hold them there. And right now, they don't seem to be persuading anyone about that, which, as you highlight, is a problem. However, it's not insurmountable, because, as I talked about earlier, these higher interest rates are going to impact consumers and corporations as their debt rolls. So even if you're a junk borrower and you've seen your borrowing costs that actually got up over 9% in junk yields, and they're now back, you know, around 8.2. So even though you've seen an easing in those conditions, they're still up from 4% before the Fed started tightening. So that whole terrain between 4% and 8.2% has the potential to catch a lot of borrowers who are unable to manage that higher debt service, especially those zombie corporations that you alluded to earlier. And they have a combined $1 trillion in debt on their balance sheets, which I imagine will all just go up in a puff of smoke. And as to the question as to why, which you mentioned briefly, why that hasn't happened already, I think a lot of it is that those loans are on the balance sheets of sort of private equity managers. You know, I thought I had silenced this. Apologies.
No worries.
So, and there was a whole piece in the Wall Street Journal today about how these guys aren't marking to market, not surprisingly. And so they have the ability, because these are, you know, private loans, to, you know, basically kick the can down the road and just see if they can string these companies along, which I imagine they'll try to do as long as possible. But at some point, they're going to realize these just aren't viable enterprises. And I think things like FTX, we'll see more of that. That sort of thing only exists in a world where there is so much free money that people aren't paying any attention. You know, under that repressive rate regime where you've got to get yield anywhere you can, you're not asking questions. Some, you know, sweaty teenager comes in and box, you know, in shorts and tells you he's got this great crypto thing going and you hand him a ton of money without asking any questions. That's not going to be the case going forward. But we can get into that whole topic as well.
Yeah, well, so a couple quick things here. So one is, I was talking about this with Lance the other day, especially with these private entities that we don't have as much transparency in, mm-hmm. right? It's sort of like what you were saying with the way the market is looking, is nonchalant right now because, yeah, the Fed's hiked a lot, but, you know, everything's still fine, right?
Right.
These private companies, they're much more opaque. And so they look fine, they look fine, they look fine, and then they're dying, right? Yeah. You know, it's like an FTX, like you said, right? And I sort of think of it like a tree, you know, with a lumberjack. He's hitting it with the axe, he's hitting it with the axe, he's hitting it with the axe. The tree is still standing there. And then all of a sudden, with the correct axe swing, bang, the whole thing falls over, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why I like this idea that it's an interest rate shock, not a tightening cycle, because right. you're going to go from everything's great to, oh my God, everything's awful, you know, in one blink, I think.
And I think that's a really key thing to underscore for the folks that are watching this video, because it's human nature, right? It's like, hey, if I don't see it happening, why worry about it, right? And I think the thing here is these things tend to be exponential, which means once you actually notice the activity, once you can see it, it's way too late to avoid it. You just have to manage the outcome. Right.
And it wouldn't take anything really cataclysmic to get it started. For example, what we're talking about in this zombie area where you have companies that really had no, a zombie corporation, just for a quick definition, is a company that doesn't generate enough income to service its debt. That $1 trillion that existed on balance sheets of zombie corporations was companies that couldn't service their debt before the Fed started raising rates.
Right, so, when the Fed funds rate was zero.
Right. So, for example, CCC rated debt, which would probably apply to a lot of these corporations, their borrowing costs went from 6% at the lows before the Fed started tightening to 14% today. So that's a massive, you know, it's a more than doubling. And so what happens in this space, and I'm by no means an expert on leveraged loans in the whole CLO space, but these CLOs, which are the vehicles, this is all reminiscent of the global financial crisis where they would take the mortgages and package them up and securitize them and sell them out. So they're doing the same thing with these loans, these two zombie corporations, basically. But the CLOs can't hold more than something really low, like it's less than 10%. Of the lowest rated quality levered loans. So it's like 8%, I think, of the CLO can have that lowest rating. So it would only take a downgrade by one of the, you know, major ratings agencies to push a huge swath of this debt into that lower rating category, at which point the CLO manager either has to sell that distressed paper and good luck finding a buyer for that at that point, or he has to turn around and buy a higher quality asset so that the balancing lifts, you know, it pushes that low quality debt to a smaller percent of the total. But there again, good luck finding higher quality paper in a market that's going to be increasingly shut because it's in the grips of this, you know, concerns about credit quality. So that could become a major issue. That's really the flashpoint, I think, for the corporate credit crisis, because it's the weak link in the chain. So it's something to keep an eye on.
So, you know, back in the global financial crisis, the ratings agencies were notorious for not having, changed their ratings at all, even when it was crystal clear to everybody that the companies were way worse off than they were being purported to be. Did the agencies, they learn their lesson from that? Do you think they'll be a little more quick to response, or will it be same old, same old?
Well, we'll see. I've been tracking corporate credit ratings on Bloomberg every day. And what I've noticed is that we have seen a dramatic flip in ratings. So in January of last year, upgrades in total corporate space, I'm not talking about zombies, I'm talking about all corporate debt, upgrades were outnumbering downgrades by 3-1. And now you flash forward a year and we got as low as two downgrades for every upgrade. So the ratio is flipped. And I think right now we're, you know, it's 0.7, basically 0.7 upgrades for every downgrade. So it's, you know, it's middling, but the pole position has been, is, you know, the baton has been passed to downgrades from upgrades. So it's a much weaker backdrop in terms of credit quality, and the ratings agencies seem to be on top of it so far. And there have been a lot of work done on this levered loan space and the risks associated with that. So I think people are on it. But, you know, as we've been talking about, the problem is that so far there hasn't been any catastrophe. And the longer that happens to be the case, the more it will imbue complacency and people will stop worrying about it. And that's probably exactly when the crisis will hit.
Okay. Well, folks, you heard it here first. If you're worried about the precariousness of the system, it sounds like credit ratings are one of the Jenga pieces way down at the bottom of the tower that if it gets moved, could send the whole thing toppling down. All right, Steph, I got a couple more questions for you. And then I do want to honor my promise to folks who have taken some Q&A from the live audience. So, you know, we've talked about the market fighting the Fed, right? Which is crazy because it just spent the past decade, you know, riding the don't fight the Fed bull.
Right.
And it's so funny how that mantra apparently makes a ton of sense to the market when things are going up and it refuses to abide by it when they go down.
Yeah.
So it you know, what I heard you say was, look, I'm synopsizing here, so correct me if I'm wrong here, but basically what I heard you say, or at least what I intuited from you said, is, you know, all that really has to happen is Powell just has to be able to deliver on what he said he's going to do. You know, if he raises to 5 and holds there for a couple quarters, you know, the market's not going to be able to maintain its level of sanguineness. It's going to start to say, okay, yeah, you know what, this is going to create a lot of shoes to drop from here, and I got to start repricing, right? So, and you're nodding. Well, everybody can. I don't have to say you're nodding as I'm saying this. People can actually see this.
Right, I'm nodding in agreement.
So in many ways, and of course, there's a lot of other things that could happen on the way there, ratings downgrades, you know, just something breaking, whatever, that could hasten all of this. But it sounds like it will happen. The Fed will win out if Powell just sticks to his course. So it all comes down to Powell's backbone.
Yeah.
At this point in time, he's going to be speaking tomorrow. What do you expect from him?
Well, you know, we are lucky now that we have a mouthpiece to tell us exactly what to expect in the form of Nick Timrose at the Wall Street Journal, who's the designated spokesperson for the Fed. So, you know, my expectations are 25, and I would expect that Powell will continue to sound hawkish in the presser. If he doesn't, then we know that he's actually the guy from 2018 that pivoted. But if he is this embodiment of Volcker 2.0, he really needs to continue to drive home the message that interest rates aren't going lower anytime soon, and try to see if he can get that Fed funds futures curve to bend to his desires. I mean, right now, the Fed funds futures curve continues to price in rate cuts, around 50 basis points of rate cuts in the second half of the year. So they see the peak Fed funds rate being hit in May, and then the next meeting, they're going to be cutting rates according to the futures market. And so what Powell needs to really underscore is that's not going to happen. So you can take that out of your mind. And obviously the dot plots from their last meeting showed nobody expecting any cuts in 2023 on the Federal Reserve Board. One other really wonky, nerdy thing to get into with regard to that timing, which is, you know, a peak Fed funds rate in May and then a potential rate cut starting in the summer, is one of the things, or I would say one of the cloaks that the Fed is hiding behind to maintain its tight policy is the inflation data. And obviously, as you mentioned at the top, it's slowing dramatically, obviously from extremely high levels, and it's way too high for the Fed's comfort. But the rate of change is such that It's really moving toward their 2% target quickly. And in fact, and the reason I go through this little tangent, if we assume that the CPI rises 0.2% every month between now and June, which is actually higher than it's been running, the CPI will be at 2% year on year by June. So we'll come from 6.5 to 2 in just 5 months' time. The math is such that you will just mathematically get there very, very quickly. So, and the Fed knows this, I'm sure they're aware. I mean, any moron with a spreadsheet can do this math. But the problem is for the Fed that the math then reverses in July, August, September, it starts to go back up. So they have a tailwind for the CPI going into that moment where the markets expect them to pivot. And if they do pivot then, they're going to get smacked in the face with higher CPI readings as we go into the second half of the year. So they would look like the biggest clowns if that happened, you know, if they told the markets month after month after month, you know, we're going to be tighter longer, and then they cave just in time to see the inflation numbers move back up again.
That's Jerome Powell as Arthur Burns 2.0, right?
Exactly. And he has to be mindful of that. Again, you know, they have access to these numbers.
I mean, to me, we're viewing from the cheap seats, it seems like that's what he's most mindful of, right? Yeah. And he's just so, okay, I got a couple questions I got to squeeze in the remaining time here on this theme. One, Steph, when you've been on before, you have said that you wouldn't be surprised not just to see disinflation in 2023, but to see actual potential deflation, you know, if we get the recession that you think we're going to get. Is that still an accurate statement?
Yeah, I mean, I just keep going back to that period in 2008. In July of 2008, the CPI, you know, I forget this, everyone forgets it. The CPI was 5.6%. I mean, I tend to think that inflation's been below 2% pretty much my whole lifetime, but it was 5.5% in July of 2008, at which point, you know, the housing bubble had already burst and the economy is slowing, et cetera. Within 12 months, it was minus 2.1. So a financial crisis has the power to flip the switch from inflation to deflation really, really quickly. And that's the catalyst that I would see for that kind of situation again today.
Okay. Let's assume for a minute that the market gets what it wants, right? That the Fed pivots by beginning of summer, right? I just want to, I've got my last chart here up my sleeve. So let me pull it up here. Here is a chart from Alf Pecatiello, who I interviewed recently. He's going to be tomorrow's video. He's showing what happened back in 2001, when the Fed cut rates by 475 basis points. And he says, and yet this is how assets performed. And look at what happened to the stock market here.
Yeah. Right?
And this is just one Fed rate cut campaign, you know, going into a recession or happening during a recession. There are other ones in history like this, where it does generally take stocks a couple of quarters to respond, you know, to bottom and to start reversing after the Fed pivots. And so there's this mentality out there that, oh, as soon as the Fed pivots, we're back to, you know, happy days again, right? So I always keep telling people, like, be careful what you wish for.
Right.
Because unless Powell is the world's, you know, biggest faker and has the biggest glass jaw, which I admit maybe could be possible.
Right. Yeah.
You know, where was I going to go with this? What was I talking about?
I mean, it's pivoting as saving the stock market, which, you know, I would say.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. So let me just get my thought out so you can respond to it, which is, you know, he does seem to say, look, for as long as I humanly possibly can, I'm going to get to five and pause. Mm-hmm. Right. If he's forced to pivot, it's, you know, it doesn't seem like he's just going to decide, oh, I want to bring rates down. He's going to be forced to pivot. And if he's forced to pivot, it's probably going to be up by a systemic breakage that is not going to be a bullish thing.
Right.
You know, everyone's going to be ducking and covering because of those conditions.
Yeah, no, 100%. That's what I was going to say is that for two part. It's exactly right. The two parts of this is that number one, the markets have already discounted the pivot. So there shouldn't be a rally on a pivot. We just saw the rally in anticipation of the pivot. Right. That's what we've seen in terms of the easing of financial conditions all this time. So it's priced in. The surprise will be if they don't do it. And as you say, you know, having talked so tough, it's going to take something really, really bad to get him to pivot. And that really, really bad is not going to be bullish for the stock market. So I agree with you wholeheartedly on that score. And then, you know, just to just continue to beat this theme to death, even if they do pivot and whatever reason, let's say the markets do rally, unless junk bond yields go back to 4%, those marginal borrowers are going to have to service their debt at substantially higher rates. You know, it was 4% before the Fed started tightening. Even if it goes from 8.2 to 6, it's still a massive increase.
That's a 50% increase from what they were used to. Yeah.
Right. And those zombie companies couldn't service their debt before the rate hikes. And then I get back to this, you know, one of the great myths of the corporate balance sheet strength always points to all the cash on S&P, you know, S&P cash is over $2 trillion. They're sitting on $2 trillion in cash. Well, I got news for you. 10 companies are sitting on $2 trillion in cash.
Right.
The other 100, you know, 400 some odd companies have basically nothing. In fact, the top 10 companies do have substantially more cash than the bottom 400. And so it's the skew between the haves and the have-nots in the corporate sector makes the consumer look like nothing. You literally have a handful of companies that you could count on your hands that have all the cash and all the assets, and then there's everyone else. And that everyone else are going to get caught up in the higher rates, barring the Fed taking rates all the way back down to where they started. And in that case, as you just mentioned, the catalyst for that would be something really dire. I have a hard time seeing private credit costs following the Fed funds rate in lockstep. You would think, you know, spreads would widen out and people would be more concerned about credit risk in that scenario.
Okay, yeah. And so that's the question I had for you here, which is credit spreads are still pretty tight.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd love any thoughts you have on that, but I'll put some words in your mouth and feel free to correct them, which is I imagine that is an indicator you're watching closely, meaning, you know, for the market to really wake up to this, a sign that it's waking up is we're going to start seeing those credit spreads blow out.
Yeah, I look at the credit spreads as relates to the direction of the stock market. You know, it's just another indication of signs of concern about financial distress. But again, I think that as relates to this corporate credit cycle, spreads are irrelevant. It's all about what yield you're paying. And so whether your yield is not that much more than the Treasury's borrowing at is sort of irrelevant to you. You know, it's only all you care about is what you're borrowing at. So if you're a junk rated borrower and spreads are 50 basis points, but your interest rate you're paying is 50% higher than you were paying before, you know, you don't really care how much the federal government's paying to borrow. All you care about is being able to service your own debt at the rates that you're paying.
Okay. So let me ask that question just a second time, which is, As companies start to fail, presumably you would see spreads. I'm just saying that is this a good indicator to watch? Like once it starts to move, then we kind of have a better sense of where we are in the story.
Absolutely.
Like, okay, that tree's beginning to tip over here.
100%. So yeah, I'm sorry. I guess I
No. You gave a good point, which is a lot of these companies can still die with tight credit spreads.
Right. But, and that's the thing is, I get a lot of when I go out in meetings and everyone says, "Yeah, but spreads are tight." You know, well, that's irrelevant for the borrower. But you're right. What will happen is yields will lead spreads. Right. So eventually, that higher yield is going to create a widening of spreads as those delinquencies and defaults start to file through. Absolutely. And then you've got a problem because if you overlay spreads with the stock market, you know, it's hard to tell one from the other at that
right.
point.
They're so correlated. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, folks, one last question from me for Stephanie, and then we'll get to yours. Start asking your questions in the live feed, folks, and I'll come to it as soon as I'm done here. So I had to end with this, Stephanie. So I just recently did an interview with John Hathaway, who I understand that you know well. And one of the things that John said about the Fed was he said, I don't really think the Fed really cares where the market is. He said, you know, there's a lot of people that think it wants the market to go up because it makes its banking buddies richer. But he said, I don't think that, like, Powell really thinks about that. He said what the Fed cares about is markets being orderly. He doesn't think the Fed cares about the number, like the level that the market's at. It just wants the market to be orderly. So in other words, if we have a controlled burn and the stock market goes down 50% from here, as long as it happens in a contained way and nothing really breaks, he seems to feel like, yeah, the Fed would be probably pretty happy with that, actually, because it would remove a lot of the excess from the system. Do you have a similar viewpoint that it's really disorder and not necessarily any particular direction?
Well, I'm glad that you underscored the idea that if the markets were going down, because I do think they care about the stock market going up.
Well, right now, for sure, because they're trying to tighten stuff. Yeah,
exactly. So I guess if they got to a situation, well, I mean, we saw it last year. The market was down, you know, 20 some odd percent, and they didn't blink. They kept on tightening. So I think that's a perfect illustration of, as long as things are orderly, I agree with that 100%. In fact, you know, this will sound crazy coming from someone who never thought they would tighten in the first place. You know, I have assumed that the Fed basically is just a patsy to Wall Street, and that anytime the market stubs its toe, they're going to come running in to the rescue. And that view, frankly, has been reinforced for the better part of three decades. But then you have Powell come in and stand firm in the face of a declining stock market. And I began to think, you know, if he wants to really protect his legacy, and that's what he's really focused on, and he wants to go down as Volcker 2.0, he really needs to repeal the Greenspan put. So it's not merely an issue of undoing the excesses that were built up during the pandemic. It's undoing the excesses that have been built up for 30 years. And as you can see, it's proving to be a rather monumental task. Now, that's assuming you believe that he might actually be trying to do that, in which case, not only does he want the stock market lower, you know, he really wants to see Fed tightening not be ignored.
He almost wants to, like, break its morale, like, way almost like you break a wild horse, right? He wants it to finally just realize, you know what, I can't fight this guy.
Yeah, well, I used the analogy of, you know, tired one of Pavlov's dogs. And basically the title of that report was, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, because here's Powell trying to teach a market that's been trained for 30 years. And if it just waits, you know, long enough, the Fed's going to give it a treat. And now he's trying to say, nope, you know, no more treats are coming. And they're just sitting there salivating like, yeah, we know it's coming. You told us it wasn't coming before, and you always gave us a treat.
Yeah. And that's what's so interesting about watching this is I think you and I are kind of cheering Powell on here in what he's trying to do right now. Yeah. But the Fed is fighting a monster that it created.
Yeah.
You know, intentionally in some ways, or at least, you know, it was negligent in not taking accountability for the monster it was creating. So part of me is sort of cheering Powell on. I want him to win in this battle, but part of me has a lot of schadenfreude, which is like, yeah, I'm glad this is a tough battle for you, because this is your own stupid mess you created.
Absolutely. I will say, so you mentioned I was at this conference, and one of the attendees was Tom Honig, who was the sole dissenter when Bernanke wanted to continue doing QE in 2010 after the crisis had already passed. And, you know, Tom was staunchly against it for all the reasons that you and I would have articulated, which is, you're just basically fueling asset bubbles and you're going to put us right back in the same predicament again. So anyway, but he confessed at this conference that he thinks Powell is going to pivot. And he has much better insight on Powell and, you know, having worked with him, known him, and so, you know, I'm loath to bet against his age and experience with this. But, you know, in my heart, I feel like he's really trying to repeal that put. And if so, the market's going to be in for one hell of a rude awakening.
Yeah. Well, what's scary for those of us hoping that Powell wins is that the bond market thinks he's going to pivot too, agrees with Tom, right? Like, and that's the smartest money on Wall Street.
Well, I would say with regard to the bond market, I could see a situation where the Fed pauses QT, but keeps tightening or doesn't cut rates. Like they might hit 5% on the Fed funds rate. And then because things start to get disorderly in the Treasury market, which I think has a high probability, that they, like the Bank of England was forced to do with their pension crisis, end up pausing QT. But they'll insist that that is in no way an easing of financial, of monetary policy. But, it's just one thing that I would think is not outside the realm of possibility, because that the QT is just, I don't even know what they're thinking about because the math doesn't work, but that's a topic for a totally different.
Yeah, maybe we should earmark that, because I think I've read arguments of people saying the Fed could pivot, meaning it could start bringing rates back down, but it could continue QT as well.
Huh.
Which would be interesting too.
Yeah.
So, all right. All right. Look, I'm having to navigate through all the, Stephanie, why aren't you a professional model questions here?
Someone posted in anticipation of this that they thought I had had a nose job, and I died laughing. I was like, if I paid for this nose, that guy would be sued to kingdom come.
Come on. All right. Let's see here. So I can actually do this too. I'm so all powerful on this show. Max P asks, do you see consumer credit card defaults reaching critical levels this year?
And?
Yeah, I think the number two question got cut off.
Okay.
I don't see it, but let's start with that first one.
I think we are starting to see the default cycle begin. And so I would expect that to continue, especially as we get into this period where you start to see more widespread layoffs that will obviously start to find many more people out of work. And it doesn't look like we're going to see another round of fiscal stimulus to bail those people out, given the logjam in Washington right now. So, yeah, I would expect that credit card default cycle to ramp up in earnest. But again, my real focus is on the corporate credit side, because while we will see a cyclical increase in consumer delinquencies, I don't think it's going to be the crisis. I think the crisis will be on the corporate side, where that you're already seeing banks shore up loan loss reserves in anticipation of a consumer default cycle. It's the corporate side where people are ill prepared.
Yeah, I did, Max, also in a, I think it was this past weekend's video with Lance, put up a chart from Discover Financial, the credit card issuer, and they saw defaults like more than double, basically, from their previous 2-year average. So they are beginning to see it. I had Lucky Lopez on this channel talking about the defaults that he's seeing in the auto loan market. And funnily, or not funnily enough, scarily enough, it's not just with the subprime lenders or borrowers, of which there were a gazillion during the pandemic. I mean, it was this era's version of the bad loans that were made during the housing crisis. But he also said there was a doubling of the percentage of defaults in the prime borrower market. It's a relatively low number of defaults or low percentage of defaults, but it has doubled. And that's a really concerning sign.
That's all the crypto millionaires who are no longer millionaires, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They bought the, whatever.
The McLaren.
Yeah. And then I'll mention this briefly, but the other thing that Lucky talked about was how people gamed the system there, Steph. This was fascinating, where people would come in, they would, sign the lease for the car, and then they would literally, like 2 weeks later, call the lender and say, my personal situation's changed and I need a forbearance. And they could get the forbearance under the COVID protections. So they were going in just to basically loan a car for free for a year or more.
Wow.
It's going to get repossessed at some point in time, but in the interim, I'm going to be able to
drive this fancy car.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing.
All right. And then you probably also saw the headline of KB Homes.
Yes, I did. Stunning. Yeah. 26% cancellation. Or no, was it 26 or 62?
68%.
Okay.
68% yeah. cancellations for Q4 2022. And it was something like 13 or 16 Q4 of 2021. So, you know, more than two thirds of their contracts broken, which yeah. actually costs, you know, those clients money, you know, to walk away. Right,
right? Walk away from the deposit. But that gets to my point about it being a shock. And when it happens, you know, the hit is going to be really profound. It's not going to be gradual. It's going to be quite severe. Anyway.
Sorry. Okay. Let me ask this one here. This is from Adam Nielsen Kaludi. Compared to the taper tantrum in 2018, this is a much more aggressive hiking. How could this not be much worse for stocks? What am I missing? I think this is what you've basically been saying.
Right. You're not missing anything, Adam. You're right on it. Dead right.
Yeah. All right. Let's see here. God, there's a lot of comments here. Let's see this. Let's try this one. Haven't even ready yet. Considering the financial conditions worsening, can anyone answer why this market is rallying? I'll let you go there, Steph, but I would say, you know, it's funny. It used to be Powell's going to pivot and we're trying to front run the pivot. Maybe some of that is still going on right now. I think part of it is front running. There is a bullish story out there about China, right? Yeah. Which is that, yeah. Hey, China's opening back up and, you know, we're going to see a big boost from that. I think there's some of that conditioned in here, but I also think to a certain extent, like the only credible bullish argument that I personally can come up with right now is just that stocks are going up. And so they're like, hey, stocks are going up, so let's buy them while they're going up. So anyways, what do you think?
No, I agree. I think that it's built on this idea that the Fed's going to pivot and that will be, you know, prevent any severe dislocations. And then you layer on top. In fact, the IMF, I think, upgraded its assessment for global growth because of China reopening. And there was a lot talked about at this conference as well. You know, the Chinese people have been in lockdown for a long time. And they built up a massive pool of saving because they haven't been able to go out and spend. So they're basically behind us. They're going to go through the same thing we did when we reopened and everyone kind of made up on all their lost dinners out and trips and whatnot. The thing is that, you know, you can't export necessarily Chinese eating out at restaurants and going to Macau to gamble. What is going to affect us in terms of China's reopening is the demand for commodities, oil in particular, and we're seeing that already. Exactly. Well, it's inflationary on the input side, whether that can get passed along. So to me, this is just another fly in the ointment of the earnings picture in terms of China reopening and putting, you know, relentless pressure on commodity prices, which are already starting from a high level. So that's just another sort of tax on growth here.
Okay. And that was kind of what I wanted to get with you on this, which is there's, you know, a boost in demand, right? Which is quote unquote good, right? For economic growth. Mm-hmm. There is the demand on commodities, which are still richly priced in a number of cases. And so that's going to squeeze margins from an input standpoint. Mm-hmm. And this is likely to be a surge, right? It's not necessarily going to be a permanent plateau, right? So I guess one, it sounds like what I'm hearing you saying is net, you think it's not going to flip the weakening global, the declining global growth figure that I showed at the beginning of this discussion. It's not going to change its direction to head higher.
Well, I think you'll see an increase of, you know, Chinese tourists traveling around the world and, yep. and that I don't know that that's going to be significant enough to offset the headwinds that, you know, the Fed, the ECB, the BOE and the Bank of Japan, et cetera, are all now undertaking. I think we haven't talked about Japan, but I think what they did with their monetary policy is kind of interesting as relates to this whole thing. We are starting to see countries try to address the issue of higher commodity prices. And I think that's one of the reasons why Japan expanded the ban that it will allow JGBs to travel in. I mean, essentially, this is all kind of a nuance, but I think the Bank of Japan wants to see a stronger yen because oil prices are high to begin with, but paying oil in dollars, which is what they have to buy their oil in, right. When your yen is incredibly weak, was becoming especially punitive for them because they import something upwards of 80% of their oil. They basically have no domestic oil production. So, right.
I mean, they import almost everything, but yes.
And so that, yeah, exactly. And so the weak yen was really a problem. And so I think we're going to start to see that kind of calculus shift in, you know, the more commodity prices stay at this level and the more China's reopening pushes them even higher, let's say, the more you want to tilt a preference to a stronger currency rather than a weaker one. And that's a secular shift. You know, for years and years, these economies, Japan in particular, have been trying to gain export advantage by having a weaker yen so that they could export all their technology and whatnot to U.S. consumers. So this is it could be a potentially major shift in the way they conduct monetary policy and what their priorities are. Anyway, that's right. A massive tangent, but just an idea to throw out there.
Yeah, well, and flagging maybe another discussion that we have you back on for the monetary repercussions of all that. All right, well, what's interesting is, you know, going into the end of last year, I was hearing from a lot of experts on this channel, what I kind of refer to as like the Zuloff theory, which is he's thought that things were going to get worse in the first half of 2023. And then he thought that the Fed's going to pivot. And then you're going to have this sort of delayed reactions, right? Where you're going to have a few things that are going to recover right away, precious metals, bonds. And then it was going to take stocks, you know, a quarter or two to bottom and then respond, right? I don't know, though. I mean, I could see now the first half of the year maybe could be somewhat supported by what's going on with China, and then the wheels really come off mid-year. So I don't know. I can kind of make arguments on both sides, and I'm kind of hearing people make arguments on both sides. Do you have let me tell you what I think you would say, and then you totally correct it.
Okay.
But I would think you would say that things are going to continue worsening through H1. But it might be a lot of those wax against the tree, right? Where it might not look so bad. And we might still kind of have this tug of war between market euphoria and the Fed talking tough and whatnot. But then around mid-ish year, we're just not going to be able to deny the failure factor of a lot of the parts of the system here. And then the wheels are really going to come off.
Yeah. And I guess a window into that will be corporate profits, the earnings announcements. I mean, we're right in earnings season right now, and the guidance that we're getting for the out quarters will be really important to watch because, frankly, the earnings have held up much better heretofore than I would have expected, given right. what we've seen in terms of economic activity. And that's not to say there aren't a lot of shenanigans going on in terms of the accounting footwork that they're doing behind the scenes. But that, again, you know, we'll see what happens. That has the ability to keep the markets held together for a while. If the guidance continues to be reasonably constructive, the markets might look through weak fundamental data because they always put a preference on what they're hearing from companies over what they're what's hitting the tape in terms of government data. And I don't have any problem with that. I mean, I think there's plenty of reason to be suspicious of the government data. I happen to think there's a lot of reason to be suspicious about what companies are telling you too. But so it really, in my view, it'll come down a lot to what we hear from companies. And right now it's a little too early to tell about this earnings season.
Okay. So I'm going to get you out of here in about 5 minutes, Stephanie. We're going over a little bit. Thank you so much for giving us much of your time. There's a bunch of questions. I may try to condense into just two general questions. One is real estate. What are your thoughts on real estate for the year?
That's such a tricky one because it's definitely something you can't paint with one brush. Obviously, we've seen the huge drop in volumes. We saw sales, you know, new and existing home sales were down, you know, 30% and 40% from their peaks. And price generally follows. And we are starting to see that now around the edges, you know, in the hottest areas. I think San Fran, there was some statistic that just came out about San Francisco prices starting to come down, not surprisingly. So I think, just so you know,
this is a Wolf Richter chart that's been going around, which I have trouble believing just because I live out in the Bay Area and I haven't seen this yet, but it's 30% price decline from their peak in May.
Huh. Wow. That's a haircut.
That is a big number.
But I mean, you're still talking about from a peak that was completely obscene.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So it's not like these people are taking any major losses. They're just not making as much as they thought they had at the top, I guess. But I think, you know, it's very hard to generalize about real estate because I do think you really want to have hard assets in the environment we're going into right now, where I think while they won't pivot now, we will have some kind of crisis that forces the Fed, as you talked about, Adam, to come in and provide support. And when they do, the amount of support that's going to be required will be so big that you really, you know, the integrity of the dollar will be called into question. You really want to have hard assets. And that's when you worry about, you know, protecting yourself against the inflation as a result of all the stimulus. But that's quite a ways down the road. But that said, you know, there's another moving part on the real estate story. And that is, you and I have talked a lot about this forthcoming potential pension crisis, and it's all at the state and local level. And so those states that are already underfunded right now, if the economy does slow and the market's correct, like I anticipate they will, those states are going to have to raise taxes and cut spending dramatically because they're forced to run balanced budgets. So as the wheels come off the markets and their pension shortfalls expand, they have to implement these countercyclical economic policies. So the flight out of states like New York, New Jersey, Illinois, California will accelerate because those taxes, which are already obscene, are going to go even higher, and the services are going to get cut because they have to, you know, lay off policemen and firemen and etc.
Right. And as we've talked, it's going to be enraging for those that stay and pay the higher taxes who don't have pensions and are saying, wait a minute, why am I not getting rescued and I'm having to pay for these guys' rescue? If I can give you just a quick example of that. So here in California, you know, our state is highly dependent upon income and capital gains taxes. Mm-hmm. Past couple of years was flush, right?
Yeah, so flush they were sending money out to people, right? The gas rebates and the inflation rebates.
Well, that's over now. We're now running a massive deficit. So, you know, it swings real quickly, right? We have a year like 2022 and the housing market goes down, or even forget that, just stops growing, right? You don't have those capital gains anymore. The coffers dry really fast. So our public transit system in the San Francisco area, in the Bay Area, is called BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit. And they have just announced massive cuts to BART because ridership is still at like 30% of pre-pandemic levels because of large part the work from home and all the layoffs that are happening here in the tech sector. So they have now said that the BART line between Berkeley and San Francisco, Oakland and San Francisco, those two are going to be shut down by 2025. Right? Wow. That's like the main corridor. I mean, that's who's commuting, right? Is folks between those two cities. Mostly. Huh. And that's going away because they're having to make those tough tax cuts, like you're saying, because the state tax coffers have run dry so quickly, right? So there's not even a pension crisis necessarily yet, or at least one that's being, you know, admitted to and visible. Right. And we're already making like cuts down to the bone like that in a lot of our key municipal infrastructure. So
one of the things, and this is a statistic, I had to go back and look a few times just to make sure it was actually true. But after the global financial crisis, you remember when Hank Paulson was in front of Congress and he was begging for his bazooka and he got his
down on his knee. Yeah.
Right. $787 billion, which sounds so quaint right now in the scheme of our multi-trillion dollar things. But anyway, so they had that federal stimulus, the American Recovery Relief Act or whatever they called it. And you could barely see it in terms of economic activity. Like we barely blipped up at all. And the reason why is that all of that federal stimulus was being offset by state and local restraint because, like you're talking about already in California, they had to cut services and raise taxes to bring their budgets back into balance. And that drag from state and local governments continued to tax total U.S. growth for 4 years after the crisis, from the crisis onward. So it that drag can last for a very long time.
It's like a long-term anchor.
Yes.
All right. Well, look, your answer there was a great segue into my last question, which was precious metals. Again, there's been a number of questions about it, so I'm just wrapping them into, you know, Stephanie, I know that you have been fairly pro gold in the past. Given your outlook right now, is that evolving at all?
You know, all conversations and all roads lead to gold. In my like, it's the perfect endpoint because it's the antidote to everything that we just talked about. 100%. I'm not just sort of interested in gold. That's, you know, I would say a core position. Of course, you can now get 4.7% on cash, so that's nothing to sneeze at. But I think that gold is really going to take on an increasingly important role. And if the Fed does pivot or is forced to pivot, obviously that would greatly inure to its benefit. But I have to say, you know, people bemoan gold's performance last year. And yet, in my view, it was one of the most impressive performances I've seen. If you had told me that the Fed was going to tighten more aggressively than Paul Volcker, I never would have thought that gold would have done anywhere near as well as it did. It was essentially flat on the year, which is just a Herculean performance in the face of this unprecedented tightening by the Fed. And so it gives me great hope about where we can go going forward. And that's before even getting into a whole conversation about, you know, the global movement away from the dollar into new alternatives for trade and financial flows, et cetera. So that's another conversation for another day.
Yeah, I was gonna say one more conversation for another day. Just on that one point, interesting point I heard recently, and I think it might've been John Hathaway who made it, which is there are these sort of, you know, blocks that are emerging and talk about, okay, this block might create its own currency or whatever, right? And the thinking there is, you know, the different blocks aren't going to be, they don't trust each other, and they're not going to trust each other, you know, any more than they do now. And so what's going to be interesting is everybody's not going to trust everybody else, but the one asset that everybody does trust and will hold in reserve is gold. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, it becomes kind of this common, you know, theme amongst enemies that, like, all right, we can disagree on everything else, but we're all going to agree that this thing actually has real value.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that gold and oil will take on increasing importance in this conversation about, you know, alternate currency regimes over the next few years. And I think that conversation is one that is going to really enter more soon. I think, you know, for a long time, I have a chart showing, you know, the dollar share of global currency reserves, and it's been going down since 2000. You know, the dollar's been a shrinking share as global central banks have tried to diversify away from the dollar. But obviously, there are a lot of things that have greatly accelerated that movement just in the last year, not least being Russia's invasion of the Ukraine and the weaponization of reserves, et cetera. Yeah. And this will be an accelerating dynamic, and one that, you know, people who hubristically assume that the dollar is the cleanest dirty shirt and therefore there is no alternative and, you know, it's never going away as a reserve currency are probably going to have to rethink that in, you know, the next year or two.
Right. Or not necessarily going away as a reserve currency, but going away as the reserve currency, right? There will be other competitors coming in. All right. Well, look, I hate to leave it there, Stephanie, because we've got about 5 hours of additional content here we've already earmarked.
We have lots of opportunity to do this again. So it's
well, and that's a great segue into my closing here. So a couple of things to let folks know about. So you are going to be one of the featured speakers at the Wealthion conference coming up on March 18th, Saturday, March 18th. And we will have a presentation from you. We're going to go, you know, a little more deeply into some, you know, sort of specific action steps to take that we had a chance to get to talk about in here. But then we're also going to have more Q&A where literally, you know, you'll just be there taking whatever questions folks want to ask you. So folks, if your question didn't get asked today, there's a very good chance it may get asked at the conference. So folks, if you want to go learn about the conference, go to the URL I have on the screen here, wealthion.com/conference. If you're an alumnus of one of our previous conferences, you should have received an email from me already with your alumni discount code. You will get the lowest price for this conference, but that lowest price is only going to last through the week. So make sure you take action before it goes away. Everybody else, if you haven't been to one of our previous conferences, you can get the early bird pricing right now. So make sure you go get that now before it expires. I can't remember exactly when it expires. It's like 2-ish weeks or so from now, but better safe than sorry. Go register now. All right. And then Stephanie, you know, you do such a great job of setting the table for the financial advisory part of what Wealthion does, you know, connecting people with financial advisors that understand these macro issues that you and I have been talking about and do the personalized work with people to say, okay, if this is what's likely to happen in the future, how do we create a portfolio strategy for you, given your personal situation, your risk tolerance, your future needs, all that type of stuff. So these guys should be sending you some massive fruit basket or something like that just for setting the tea up so well for them. But folks, just a reminder, if you have a great financial advisor already who can do that for you, excellent. Literally stick with them. They are worth their weight in gold. And, you know, gold is as precious as Stephanie just said it was. But if you don't, or if you'd like a second opinion from one who does, then consider scheduling a free consultation with the advisors that Wealthion endorses. To do that, you just go to wealthion.com, and I've got a fancy little banner for that too. There we go. You can set one of those up. Again, these are totally free. You get a portfolio review. You tell them what you're looking to do. They tell you what they think you should do, given the conversation. Doesn't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these guys. They just offer it as a free public service, trying to get as many people as possible to position themselves prudently before, you know, the shoes to drop that Stephanie's talked about here possibly happen. And with that, folks, if you've enjoyed this live session with Stephanie, please do me a favor. Let me know in the comments section below if you'd like us to continue this format. I think it works pretty well, but would love to hear from you all. And then to help encourage Stephanie coming back on this channel in the future and getting other great minds like her on the program, please do me a favor and support this channel by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Stephanie, it's just always such a joy to have you on the program. Thanks so much for coming on.
It's my pleasure. The time flies by. So, and I should mention, if I may, you know, I now have a retail product. If any of your audience is interested in it, it's once a month, so it's not a tremendous amount of input, but you know, you get a monthly update on my doom and gloom if you don't get enough of that here.
I feel ashamed for not having asked you that question.
So where
should they go to learn more about it?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess they should go to macromavens.com, and there's a whole, you know, you can look at the how to subscribe page. So, but thank you for that. It's a shameless plug, but I feel apparently I'm supposed to do this to grow my business.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, Stephanie, so as most folks watching this know, but maybe not everybody knows, Stephanie very kindly steps in as a guest host on Wealthion from time to time to try to give me a little break to focus on some of the other stuff we're trying to create for you in the future. So she's a massive friend of Wealthion. And, any chance I get to interact with Stephanie, I do. She's one of the smartest people out there, as you obviously now know from this discussion. So go check out Macro Mavens. If you're watching this on the replay, I will put a link to it as the pinned comment below this video so you can get an easy link over there.
Thank you, Adam. You're a mensch, as they say.
No, what is it? You're a shishka? And we're going to get in trouble as the two, like,
shiksa. I think I'm a shiksa.
Yeah, see, there we go. Yeah.
Neither of us know what we're talking about. We're faking it, but
All right. Well, look, again, Stephanie, it's been wonderful. Everybody else, thanks so much for participating in this live event with us. And Stephanie, look forward to seeing you at the conference. And everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Sounds great. Thanks, Adam.